The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
1 week ago, the federal government tabled new legislation aimed at reforming the Criminal Code and Controlled Substances Act that would end mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenses and other crimes, and would increase diversion for drug offenses and to treatment. Earlier on our program this week, Tracy Draper with the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society said the move was completely disappointing after many harm reduction advocates said what was needed was a full decriminalization of controlled substances, not simply tinkering. Here is a clip from Tracy discussing this with The Pulse on CFRO on Tuesday.
Completely disappointed, yeah. I was hopeful that it would be, like, I was hopeful that also that, you know, the nonviolent criminal people that are in jail right now, I was hoping that they would announce that they would help those people, and there was no expungements either. So that was also very disappointing. For the Indigenous people and Black Canadians, 39% Black Canadians, 20% Indigenous Canadians, with mandatory minimum penalties, changing the stigma on drugs. We need to change that stigma as soon as possible, because if we change that stigma, then you don't have to worry about punishing people for it because it's no longer a stigma. Since day one, since we have been colonized, our people, it has always been about that. And I can't see it, unfortunately, changing anytime soon.
And that was Tracy Draper speaking to The Pulse. Here's a clip of the federal public safety minister, Bill Blair.
Criminal justice system has strong elements of systemic and structural racism. And that perhaps is the greatest challenge facing us as Canadians to create a more fair and diverse supportive society. And so the measures brought forward today begin, I think, with an important acknowledgement that many of the provisions being addressed in the Attorney General's legislation today have had a disproportionate impact on racialized and Indigenous people in this country. And as tragic as that can be, it also creates an unsafe situation in this country for if a young person growing up in any part of our country believes that the criminal justice system will not be just for them. Then they become alienated from society and from their community. They may be compelled to make bad choices. It can result in tragic outcomes. And those young people who are so important to the future of this country fail to reach their full potential as Canadian citizens, and quite often can end up in a criminal justice system that treats them unfairly and produces inappropriate, unacceptable outcomes. We've seen the impact that mandatory minimum sentences for many offenses has had on the disproportional injustice for racialized and Indigenous people. These measures have not made us safer. And in fact, I will tell you from perspective, and I'm not a criminal lawyer. I spent most of my adult life as a police officer and a police chief in the city of Toronto. And I can tell you the impact of the inappropriate sentencing for many of these young people has resulted in true injustice. And again, from experience, you know, Minister Labeni referred to a young person who may get caught up in a set of circumstances that if a judge was allowed to take into consideration all of the evidence and all of the circumstances of that offense and that offender, they would be able to apply an appropriate criminal justice response, either in sentencing, which may involve incarceration, but has such a large a range of interventions available to it under other circumstances. And so I strongly support the measures that are being introduced today because they will help us create fairness and justice for all of our citizens. And I think it's important to acknowledge because although some people like to talk tough on crime, let us instead be smart on crime. Sometimes individuals are simply so dangerous that society must be protected from them. And that is why we introduced just earlier this week in our firearms bill, and measures to increase the maximum penalties for certain serious gun crimes and to retain certain sentencing provisions for serious violent offenses involving firearms. Those are measures to ensure that we deal appropriately in the interest of public safety with sentencing that is appropriate. But those sentencing provisions should always be balanced with the need to make a difference in so many of those young offenders. And I'll tell you again from experience, for many young offenders who, for their first offense, who may have got caught up and made some bad decisions, not necessarily with the intent to hurt anyone or to commit a violent crime, but maybe in possession of drugs or in possession of a firearm. And when we send those young people to jail for a disproportionate and inappropriate period of incarceration, they don't come back better citizens. They come back alienated from their community and often in a far worse position and represent a greater risk to our society.
And that was Bill Blair, Canada's public safety minister. Well, here to provide analysis and reaction to the new proposed law is an expert on Indigenous sentencing. Dr. David Millward is an associate law professor at the University of Victoria. He also co-authored the Glad You Handbook, which provides resources to judges and lawyers around measures to consider the life circumstances of Indigenous offenders before sentencing, called the Glad You Principle. Here's David Millward. Thank you so much for helping us to kind of understand some of the issues around criminalization and how it impacts Indigenous people.
So we do have the problem of Indigenous over-incarceration, which continues unabated. So in fact, the numbers have gotten worse over the years. So now 28% of federal admissions to federal penitentiaries are Indigenous. And the provincial, it's at least 30 provincial jails, it's at least 30%. And in provinces like Saskatchewan, Manitoba, you're getting as much as 74-75%. And this is despite the fact that Indigenous peoples are only 3% of the overall population in Canada. And so we do, there's this case called GLADU, which mandates sentencing Indigenous peoples, but in a way that hopefully in the long run reduces Indigenous over-incarceration.
You helped actually author a major document about this, right?
Yes, yes.
The work that you authored around GLADU, what kind of, I'm not sure what that was. I just saw it in one of the academic papers I was reading that you had done some kind of important contribution to that issue.
I've often written several articles specifically around GLADU, academic articles. But Deborah Parks and myself, when we were both at University of Manitoba, and Deborah Parks is now at UBC, we authored a report on applying GLADU properly and the kind of information, for example, that's needed for a proper GLADU report, what the GLADU factors are and how they're to be applied during sentencing making, during sentencing decisions. So that's the report that we did. Yeah.
I understand that was received very favorably by the judiciary and the sort of sentencing into the courts.
It's been there for years, but overall it hasn't really made any appreciable dent in Indigenous over-incarceration. So then we have, back in the previous regime, Stephen Harper and the Tory government, they introduced several mandatory minimums, which means that These are the yardsticks. Judges can't go below this mandatory minimum, no matter what the particular facts of a case may be. And one of the areas where these mandatory minimums were introduced was for several drug-related offenses. And which drug-related offenses are some of the, is one of those things where you frequently see Indigenous accused charged with. And from the very outset, there's concerns there was a form of systemic discrimination, not just against Indigenous peoples, but Blacks as well, but Indigenous peoples in particular. And sure enough, there's been a 20% increase in incarceration. 20% of those sentenced under mandatory minimums have been Indigenous.
Now, is it just at sentencing level, or are we talking at kind of every stage from likelihood of encountering police, likelihood of actually having a prosecution, likelihood of conviction, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I believe it's admission to prison. And the way I look at this is that the repeal of these mandatory minimums, it certainly is welcome, but in some ways, it's kind of a moving the needle backwards and then moving it back to where it had originally been in the first place. Now, mind you, there's been some efforts to actually improve things beyond that. For example, increasing the eligibility for diversion or out of court drug treatment programs, a de-emphasis on criminalization there, and maybe also increasing the availability of conditional sentence, which basically means house arrest type sentences, where previously the Tory government sought to restrict the availability of those. So there is some effort to move the needle. But at the same time, on the balance, on some level, it feels like, oh, the previous government moved the needle back a certain way, and we're just moving it kind of more or less back to where it had been in the first place.
What's the fundamental problem that you see with mandatory minimums? I mean, this is something we heard about in the States from like Republican and Democrat governments for decades, and the conservatives brought them in. But what is it exactly, and why is it such a concern?
Okay, so the thing here is, when you usually have your usual sentencing case without a mandatory minimum, the judge has a lot of discretion. It's not discretion, but there's guides for it. You know, it's basically, certainly you have to take into consideration facts that make the offense more serious, like, for example, harming a particularly vulnerable victim. But there's also a mandate to take into consideration what some people call extenuating circumstances, where that might engender some sympathy for the accused, like, for example, unfortunate life circumstances where the accused himself was harmed while he was younger. And that's particularly true, for example, of a lot of Black and Indigenous accused, particularly Indigenous accused, where, for example, there might be intergenerational trauma or there might be abuse as a child in the background that might be behind why he's acting out the way that he's doing. And a judge could take those into consideration and make perhaps deciding that maybe a reduced sentence is merited, or perhaps even a non-jail sentence that would be more helpful for the accused could be in the cards as well. And judges, without absent a mandatory minimum, could take all that into consideration and could adjust what they saw as a fit sentence and a workable sentence. But the problem with mandatory minimums is here's your minimum floor. So, for example, if the mandatory minimum is 2 years and judges can't go below those 2 years, and it doesn't matter how much of the life story comes out or how many of those mitigating factors or life circumstances come out, the judge can't rely on those to reduce the sentence below what the mandatory minimum insists on. And that's the concern. That's why there's a concern why it amounts to systemic discrimination against Indigenous and Black inmates in particular.
It kind of brings to my mind some of the rhetoric that the Harper conservatives had about judges, because they really used a lot of got their base riled up about the so-called activist judiciary and saying, you know, judges shouldn't be committing sociology, that it's, you know, the law is hard and fast and needs to be punitive. And the mandatory minimum kind of took away some of that from judges.
Yeah. In fact, in that rhetoric, in some respects, actually misapprehended what judges are actually doing, because it's actually the government that misstated the law through that rhetoric, because taking into consideration mitigating factors or rehabilitation as an objective, those features had long been built into the sentencing law decades prior to the Harper's Tory government coming into power, and judges were doing what they've been doing and were well equipped to do for decades. The problem that I perceive is, well, for example, any sentencing case where someone, for example, gets a conditional sentence or less years than the public was expecting, and then you read the comments section for that story, oh, our bleeding heart justice system is holding crooks by the hand. You tend to see thousands of those comments follow a story like that, and there are public opinions.
I've tried to stop reading the comments, David.
And I mean, it's actually borne out by public opinion surveys, where the public very often wants harsher, more severe, longer sentences, and the Tory government was playing on that as a platform to get themselves elected.
Some people have pointed out that the Liberals made it all the way through their terms, 2 terms, and you know, potentially an election coming up this year, maybe, before even talking about undoing a very basic thing they opposed from the conservatives.
Yes. Mind you, I know at the outset, at least prior to the first election, Justin Trudeau made all kinds of sounds about repealing the mandatory minimums. And mind you, during the first term, I think there's a bit of waffling or delaying, and I suspect precisely because it's such a politically charged topic. Now that we have I suspect the reason why there's more movement on this now is because he now has a second term as prime minister. And even though he's in minority government, apparently he's actually gotten some support from the other parties, at least to go ahead with this.
Hmm. Can we talk about some of the dangers of having, you know, people's rights violated by being overrepresented in prison, and also the kind of the failure of justice that represents, just in terms of some of the side effects of having such a high incarcerated population, the harms of the over incarceration of Indigenous peoples in Canada?
In certain areas of public policy, like, for example, environment, there actually is consultation with experts, you know, like, for example, biologists or biochemists. Criminal justice is one of those areas where some, very often, the experts, actually, like criminologists, get sidelined. The research says deterrent, you know, jail and making jail longer does not deter, it does not scare people out of committing crimes, which is the ostensible purpose. And in fact, what we actually do know is that putting in people in jail, whatever they may have done beforehand, the only thing it really succeeds at is making them better criminals, because it inculcates them in a lifestyle where they're warehoused in tight quarters along with a bunch of other people who've done some nasty stuff, and, you know, put them all together, and they just learn to be more violent, to be better thieves and all the rest of it. And then when they get up, they haven't been rehabilitated. They've been made even worse. And when Indigenous peoples...
And likely possibly with potential connections to organized crime.
Exactly. Especially in the case of Indigenous inmates, where very likely they will have been recruited into Indigenous gangs, partly out of a necessity to have some, or someone has your back against the other inmates. But then, you know, getting drawn into Indigenous gangs, you know, you're setting yourself up, and then the expectation is you're going to carry on the work when you're released afterwards.
Of course, this also has a huge impact on families and communities. We've seen a lot of research around that in the States, around how highly incarcerated the Black male young population is.
Yes.
Is that similar to what we're seeing with Indigenous and Black populations in Canada in terms of the harms on community and family?
Yes. I mean, the way I look at it, there's already been significant damage to Indigenous communities from processes of colonialism, quite apart from jail. So, I mean, for example, the residential schools in the 60 scoop that tore apart Indigenous families and subjected Indigenous children to abuse, and then massive substance abuse and everything else. So a lot of Indigenous communities have been rendered into an unhealthy state by those processes, even apart from jail. But then when you send lots of Indigenous people to jail and they come back, they're not better for it, they're worse, and they just help, you know, you can't blame them because of how damaged they become, but they come back and they just help keeping this community in a further state of dysfunction and trauma, massive trauma.
Hmm. I guess my last question then for you is, looking overall at the picture of this Bill C-22, assuming it passes as proposed, would you overall say that it's a positive impact on those issues, or does it not go far enough, or both?
I would say it actually is a welcome development, because it actually moves the needle back from where it shouldn't have been in the first place. But by itself, to reverse all these problems we've talked about, no, because my expertise is in criminal justice and sentencing. I do explore Indigenous research to what we can do about those problems in the particular area of criminal justice. But I'm also the first person to admit that criminal justice reform by itself is not enough. I mean, you're looking at things like substance abuse as a health problem, helping people who are healed and traumatized from intergenerational sexual abuse or domestic abuse, lack of education, poverty. These are things that require a multifaceted, multi-pronged approach in a lot of areas besides just criminal justice. So, I mean, it's criminal justice reform is helpful, but it can only be a piece of the puzzle. It requires a much grander, larger scale effort to overcome.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's wonderful to meet you and to talk to you, and I'm glad to have some of your expertise on here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That's not a problem at all.
Thank you so much. Have a good day. And that was Dr. David Millward. He is an associate professor of law at the University of Victoria.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative. a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.